You filed a flight plan to Mountain Rescue. If we don't report in, they'll come looking for us.
Now, that's how it's supposed to work, except I put in a flight plan for Borum Caverns, and this isn't Borum Caverns, is it, Juno?
We're in the wrong cave.
Where are we?
It hasn't got a name. It's a new system. No one's ever been down here before.
Let me ask you a question. Would you prefer to stay alive without your mommy and daddy, or die with them? That's a tough question, huh?
Who's moving? It was alive. It knows we're here. We just have to go. We have
we
to
can't
go.
Do that.
You didn't see it. I'm not staying here.
If we try to leave, they kill us.
We're being quarantined here. We are being kept here to die.
While you were looking for me, I was looking for you. Well, got you now.
Was that him in the car?
Yeah, sure it was. Didn't walk very far.
Why is that?
Because I cut off his legs.
And I'm gonna do the same to you.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how are you, sir?
I am well.
Excellent. And in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts?
Hey everyone, this is Abe, long time no see.
Abe, how's it going, man?
I'm doing good.
Excellent. Though we did have you on an episode that was just released a couple of weeks ago, Volition. It was one of the ones we recorded earlier in the year.
Oh, okay.
And guess what? It's still a long time no see because this is a podcast.
That's true. We're all virtual. And a Connecticut American?
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how's it going?
Very well, thank you.
Very good. And from the Commonwealth of Virginia?
Hey, this is Barrett.
Barrett, how's it going?
Good.
Excellent. Unfortunately, co-host Mike from the state of New Hampshire, the state of New York, cannot make it tonight, but he will be rejoining us for next week. All right, so we have a couple of things. We are part of the Dark Discussions News Network for folks who have just stumbled upon us, and this is the original podcast that started it all. Which is the network is named after. We just had our 10th year anniversary. So March 13th, 2011 to March 13th, 2021. So we're now already into our 11th year. And you can find the website at darkdiscussions.com where you will find all sorts of news about movies and pop culture. So there's articles, columns, release notices, podcasts, videos and such. A lot of good stuff there. It's updated all the time, so you should check it out at least once a day, if not many times, for your genre and pop culture news. We also have an email at darkdiscussions@aol.com, or just press the contact us on the website and we will read your emails on the podcast. And we do have some other things there, Eric. What's that?
Get me to talk about is Patreon. Patreon is a service that allows you to financially contribute to your online artists like us. You can also go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions. For every $5 a month that you care to contribute, you'll have the opportunity to submit a topic for us to possibly do a show about. We take all the selections and draw one at random on a quarterly basis. Producing this show is not free. Phil, have to pay for a lot of stuff, including web server hosting and audio file hosting and equipment and movie rentals and so on and so forth. So if you would like to help offset the cost of producing this show, that's how you can do it. You can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions or follow the link on any page of darkdiscussions.com.
Excellent. That's right. And speaking of that, we just hit quarter three of 2021. Imagine that. The time, the year's flying. And we do have a new Patreon to be picked tonight. We were going to do it last week, but we decided to push it back to tonight. And I do have a randomizer up. So I will press the randomizer button here. And it is 121. So 121, let's see where that is. 121 is John Wick.
John Wick?
Oh, wow.
The first film, John Wick.
Did we cover that?
We never did as an episode, no.
Wow. Okay, cool.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, that is a good one. And it's
how did we not cover that?
I don't – oh, yeah, why didn't we cover it? It was one that I know I had never – I didn't get to see it at the theaters, and so it just got forgotten, I think. It was kind of weird.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Oh, cool. I'm down.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll do the first episode of the series, the franchise. So that's good. And thank you for folks who donate to the podcast, because you just saw it work in real life, where we just randomly picked John Wick from one of our Patreon listeners. And I believe that is Michelle Barkley that chose that one.
Of course it's Michelle. Thank you, Michelle.
Indeed, indeed. All right, sounds good. So that's pretty much that. We don't have any other information, news, or whatever. There was a couple of things, but you know, we'll talk about that after the episode. But I guess the first thing and the most important thing, and Eric will appreciate this because it is the passing of director Richard Donner of The Omen, among other
things. Yeah. Yeah, that's a bummer. He was old, so it's okay. But man, he did a lot of great movies, including probably the first successful. I don't know. I'm not going to say it was the first overall. I'm going to say it was the first successful live action superhero movie with Superman in 1980.
That's right. That's right. He also did Lethal Weapon and The Goonies, among other films. And I will say this, Eric, and I know you probably would agree and you probably have already listened, but any disc that you have or people want to buy of his where he has a director's commentary, he's one of the best director commentaries I've ever heard. So I recommend for anybody who likes his movies to get the discs if they include a director's commentary, for sure. All right, yeah, because his Omen one was fantastic. I know that.
Yes.
All right, so we'll talk about any other news or what we've been watching after the episode, because this episode is about a fairly long movie that may have a lot to talk about. So I think with that, Eric, why don't we get into our topic tonight?
Tonight, we're going to be talking about a hidden little indie gem called The Empty Man.
Sequel to The Full Man.
Hey, wait. We gotta try it.
Try what?
Calling the empty man.
Who's the empty man?
If you're on a bridge and you find a bottle, you blow into it, and you think about the empty man. Oh, come on, Mandy. How old are you?
Tell him the rest.
On the first night, you hear him. And on the second night, you see him.
And on the third night?
Well, on the third night, he finds you. Squirming his way into your thoughts. Like a disease. And his message is contagious.
That's right. The Empty Man is, well, it's a strange film because it was released and technically at theaters last year. And I know some podcasts on the Dark Discussions News Network, including I think His and Hers podcast, actually did an episode of the movie back when it first came out. It came out late October, and they did an episode in November. So people can go to darkdiscussions.com, type in His and Hers, or just type in Empty Man in the search button, and you'll find that episode. So it was released October 23rd, 2020, and then went to VOD technically a little later, but again, people were able to see it early. I got a January date. But either way, the film is a 20th Century Studio, though it still has the 20th Century Fox logo on it. Unfortunately, the film was one of those films that were inherited during the purchase of 20th Century Fox Features by the Disney behemoth. And when that happened, it was one of their films that got held back for a while and whatnot. So that did not help its cause, but eventually was released. The film stars James Badge Dale, possibly known as the partner to Matt Damon in The Departed. That's how I know him. It includes other actors like Maren Ireland and some others that I'm not too familiar with. It's directed by David Pryor.
You know Stephen Root.
Oh, yes, you're right. Yep, Stephen Root. That's right. He was in it, too. The film was directed by David Pryor in his feature-length debut based off of the graphic novel The Empty Man by Cullen Bunn, which is a fairly popular one from 2014. David Pryor also wrote the screenplay for the film. The film is getting mixed to positive reviews on Rotten Tomatoes for people who care about that. It's about 63%. Though, oddly, audiences have been giving it a lesser grade. And I think that is partly because of two things. One, the trailer, I haven't seen it, but the trailer does not put the film into what people would expect it to. So when they went to see it, they go, that's not what the trailer showed us.
And that's and, like, watch trailers.
Indeed. Indeed. And the other reason is it's because it is a unconventional film in some ways, and we'll discuss that. So I guess we'll go into how we heard about this film and what we thought about it. And yeah, I'll start. I haven't ever started, or not recently anyway, but I actually heard about this film from both Eric Webster and Jason Lloyd way back a long time ago. They were talking about it, and I think you finally just saw it recently, Eric, but I swore you were one of the people.
No, I saw it originally in January.
Yeah, okay, so it was you. It was you and Jason both mentioned it, Jason Lloyd of the Horrorphilia Network. Yes, he closed it down.
Not Jason, the network.
The network, yes. It was a good network. The film was getting good buzz, and just like, I guess, what a lot of people have seen through the critics and the regular audience, the people on social media were saying the same thing, which is they either loved it or they didn't. And my feelings on the film is it's really good. The first part, the intro is awesome. The first part or first act is really good too. The second act is a bit slow, unfortunately, but then the third act is really awesome as well. It's a long film. It's like 217 minutes, I think. So 2 hours, actually 2 hours and 17 minutes.
Yeah, it's a lengthy film.
So it's a very fairly long film. So you have to be in the right mood. It's 137.
2 hours isn't that long.
Yeah. 137 minutes, 2 hours and 17 minutes. That's it. So, for a modern film, unless it's Korean, it's a longer film, but generally, it's a good film and I would definitely recommend it, though it's going to depend on one's taste if they'll like it. But I pretty much liked it. Yeah. So let's go with Eric, who actually suggested this film.
Yeah, I stumbled across this movie quite by accident back in January. Because if you remember, we did an episode on that movie, The Dak and the Wicked, which starred Maren Ireland. And I was like, I liked her now. What else has she been in? And
That's right. That's her.
And this movie popped up. I was like, huh, what the hell is this? I've never heard of this. So I gave it a shot, and I really liked it. It's unique. It is. It's an unusual structure and unusual presentation. But there were really a lot of things I liked about the movie. The acting was good. The sound design was phenomenal.
It was.
I thought it was shot pretty well too. The story, I can understand why some people would gripe a little. This is one of those movies that, much like The Dark and the Wicked, gives you the what but not the why. So if that's going to be an issue for you, be aware of it heading into it. But overall, I thought it was a pretty cool movie.
Right, right. Yeah, that, I was wondering where I had seen that actress before. And that's right. It was The Dark and the Wicked. That's interesting. And I agree with the sound design. I actually was texting Barrett yesterday when I was watching it, and I told him that the surround sound was awesome. All right, let's go with you, Barrett.
I heard about this from Eric last week when we decided on doing this, or the week before that. I thought this movie was really, really good. I think it could have been a little shorter. Maybe a little bit of editing would have made the film a little less long and a little less slow in the middle. But other than that, it had everything that I like about a movie. It was great sound design, as Eric said. I liked the plot. It's a little weird. It's kind of reminded me of an Ari Aster film. But yeah, it's real good. I would highly suggest it.
All right, sounds good. Let's go with Chrissy.
I remember seeing the trailer for this a while back and thinking, okay, this is definitely something I want to check out. So I was really thrilled when you said that was the movie we were going to do for this week. I loved this movie. This movie was everything that I feel like films like Slender Man and The Bye Bye Man and these other sort of urban legend type things with young people starting out going into the wilderness and finding trouble or calling Bloody Mary in front of their mirrors or whatever. I really felt that this was everything that those movies could have been. It has a great mystery. It's got a crime drama in it. It's got troubled characters with complicated relationships. It has a twist that actually is very well justified. There's also a love story in there that kind of percolates under the surface, but it's very strong and it's very well communicated in very few references, which is also really good. The details are slowly and evenly meted out. I, like Eric, I echo the fantastic sound design. I agree with Barrett that this is a little bit like an Ari Aster film because some of the key themes are, you know, they have themes in common. But it also reminded me a lot of that movie with Eric Bana from 2014, Deliver Us from Evil, which was also good. And I know that, you know, we've talked about, yeah, I think the second half is a little slow. I agree with Barrett. I think they could have maybe trimmed a minute or two here or a minute or two there just to shorten it up a little. But honestly, I think people that might be deterred by the length of this film, I honestly thought it was what was needed in order to tell this type of story. Because you have so many things going on. You know, it goes from urban legend to mystery to crime drama to some kind of cult thing without spoiling it. That is a lot of stuff to throw into a punch bowl and have it make sense. And I think the story had to be carefully meted out so that it was not confusing. And I did not find that it was like slow. I think there was a little bit of a tonal shift in the middle because maybe it had to shift from one to the other. But it didn't necessarily bother me. I thought it was fine for what it needed. But I love this film and I give it high marks. So, you know, that's me. Oh, and there's a lot of subtext too, but I'm sure we'll talk about that. So,
all right, sounds good. So, we have four so far out of four. Let's see if Abe continues the streak.
So I first heard about the film as we were, you know, talking about it on our usual chat of what we would look at for the coming week, and this was a topic that was chosen. I watched it today, just keep it fresh. Probably a good idea because it is a long film and there's a lot of details and a lot of things you could forget if you just watched it a little too soon. The length I can see can be a deal breaker for some, but I think there is a nice build up to certain reveals and some. It's also because it's mainly a mystery. You know, allows for the audience and the main character to piece things together as they go along. The first 22 minutes were pretty solid. I thought, in a way, if that was snipped, that could have been like a short film that could have stood on its own for the most part. Kind of made me think of certain short horror stories and films that people on YouTube and stuff like that like to show. The quality is really strong throughout. There's great, and I definitely had to echo about the sound design. There was really, it was very effective in how it was handled. There was some really great visuals, both disturbing and both really trippy. And it's, you know, I think it's an overall strong film. There's some points where I could see some extra bits of fat that we trimmed off to make it a little, streamline it just a little. But at the same time, I think it can stand, you know, as it is as well. Overall, I've had a good experience with it. There wasn't anything I didn't really like. I kind of wish that certain things could have been a little more like, you know, for the reveal could have been sprinkled a little more effectively. But at the same time, I thought this was a good movie and. Hell, I think it's going to be an interesting topic to get back into after a long hiatus.
All right, sounds good. Very well. So with that, Eric, do we have a wiki?
Wiki.
I don't know why I'm doing that. That just made me laugh. I've done it so many times, but tonight I found it particularly funny. Sorry. Let me get my shit together.
Wiki.
On the trail of a missing girl, a next cop comes across a secretive group attempting to summon a terrifying supernatural entity.
All right.
I don't know how accurate that is, but it's a neat little tagline.
I mean, it'll grasp attention.
Yeah, it doesn't give too much away.
Right.
Yeah, it doesn't talk about any twist, doesn't talk about whether or not they actually are summoning something, or is it just some kooks? You know, so we don't know. Yeah, so it's all right. I mean, but yeah, it's not necessarily fully accurate either. But all in all, good enough. All right, so that's pretty much the wiki. So folks who are curious about Dark Discussions, the first thing is we're recording this July 8th, 2021. So just a few days after 4th of July. Or Independence Day in the U.S. of A., and only a few days before Bastille Day in France, and only a few days before or after Canada Day. But either way, that's for folks who care, because some folks want to know when we record each episode.
Thank God I was getting my holidays for July all fucked up. I am so glad you clarified that, Phil.
Indeed. Yep, Canada and Bastille Day, we all celebrate. Now,
July 15th in Canada is Maple Syrup Day.
Ooh, yum.
Okay, I'm still making pancakes now. Thank you for that.
That is maple syrup is usually in March. I mean, I don't know why. Either way, also the other thing is for folks who are curious, we do spoil. So basically, we are not just a review podcast, but we also critique and dissect specific scenes, details, what the director or screenwriter may be trying to say, important aspects of the film that we want to talk about that would just spoil the film and all that. So we do throw up a spoiler alert in a bit. So that's just a heads up. But until we get there, we can pretty much talk about anything in anything generally. And I guess one of the things of note is, yeah, Abe, I think you're right. The first 22 minutes of the film, because it is a weird intro, because it's a 22-minute length intro to the film before you even get to
the title
screen.
Yeah, isn't it awesome?
It's so awesome. Boy, I texted Phil right after I finished that first 15 to 20 minutes, and I was like, this film is awesome.
It's actually 22 minutes. And yeah, it's a pretty awesome beginning, but that's one of the reasons why the film, I guess you could say, is extended length compared to a normal horror film. But Abe did have a good point, which is it could be its own independent film.
Absolutely. That could be a short film.
Yeah, and I think it would work beautifully as a short film because it's got that little twist you don't see coming right at the end of it.
Agreed. Yeah.
You know, so that would totally work. And then are we actually spoiling right now or are we not spoiling at this moment?
Not yet. But okay. We'll be there shortly. We'll be there shortly, yeah. A really, really good 22 minutes, very suspenseful, stressful, if you're a person that enjoys thrillers and horror. And then, of course, the ending is amazing, what happens. Not that it wasn't something that you could guess was going to happen, but it was. It wasn't like a surprise, but it was like still shocking as heck. That was interesting. Another thing that's odd about this film is you could argue that the film is a science fiction horror film rather than true supernatural, right?
That's why I said the little blurb was inaccurate. It's because I don't think it's supernatural.
Yeah. Well, I know that some of the reviews I looked at afterward but didn't really read, I just wanted to get a sense of what people were saying. They are classifying it as supernatural, and
well, they're wrong.
I mean I also saw some Ready Poe-esque things in here too, so there's a lot. I think you could really go either way with that.
Well, the Venn diagram,
or both. That's what makes this film so interesting. Is you could really kind of label it any way you want. It sort of fits into three or four different things that I can think of.
There's a lot of subgenres squashed into there, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and that's the thing. You know, I always throw up the Venn diagram where it can be all sorts of things in the middle, but it also could be, off to the side too, depending on your perspective. And I think this film fits that way. So. I could see people thinking it is supernatural because it is possibly a cult or outer beings or something. But I could also see it being science fiction for sure because it's using how things occur.
Yeah, after we get past the spoiler flag, I'll tell you why I don't think it's supernatural.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, I'll be curious to hear that.
Yeah, but I think I'm going to probably be right on board with you, Eric, though I do want to hear your thoughts. Anything else that anybody wanted to bring up generally?
Well, I do too.
Go ahead, Eric.
Okay. I really like the bottle theme, blowing into the bottles.
Oh, yeah. I kind of love that. Yeah.
Yeah, from the sound perspective on to just – what it was doing. I just thought it was a neat theme how they use that throughout.
Especially being more of a modernized version of the old ancient flute that's found in the cold open.
Yeah,
I like that too. And I thought it was a very original kind of reframing of the Bloody Mary thing.
Yeah, definitely.
Really different. And certainly that atmosphere in that opening is amazing. With the mist and the storm blowing in, and even when they do the day one, the day two the day mm-hmm. three over the snow. Wow, did that look like Kubrick's The Shining. I was sitting there going, I wonder if they did that on purpose, because that is really well done. Because in the second half of the film, when we're in Missouri, when we're in St. Louis, they do tell you day one, day two, day three, but they don't do it the same way.
What's interesting,
this way it's with a thump, like that stamp, like that sound, like that boom, day one. And that's exactly what they do in The Shining.
Yeah. But what's interesting is that, you know, we get this this style repeated also when we get into the main part as well. As we go through, you know, first day one, day two, and day three with our main character. Which was an interesting little echo.
One thing about the presentation of the film that I had a very strange experience with last night when I was rewatching it is that partway through the movie, all of a sudden I started thinking it looked really obvious that it had been shot digitally. And I didn't have that experience the first time I watched the movie. And the switch kind of happened. If you remember, there's a scene where he ends up in a cabin. All I'll say for now.
Yeah.
Around that time in the movie, all of a sudden stuff started looking super digital to me. But I realized afterwards that right about that time, the sun went down while I was watching the movie. And I wonder if that had something to do with my perception, is the fact that there was no longer sunlight coming through the window. But anyway, that's a little weird experience I had while I was watching the movie.
That is super interesting, Eric, because you know what? I was watching it on a tiny phone.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching it on a phone at work, everyone, okay? Just, I'll admit it. I was watching it at work.
Busted.
But here's the interesting thing. That opening sequence, which I thought was beautifully shot and well done, even though I was watching it on a teeny phone, there were a couple of moments in that opening where I was like, oh my God, that is so digital. Like, I could just tell it was digital for whatever reason. And like, I'm used to that now. So it doesn't bother me. Because I understand that that's just how movies are made. And, you know, but it almost looked like that old fashioned green screen to me, you know, where they're driving in the car and you see the fake, you know, film behind them. That's kind of what it looked like to me, except it was like the Himalayan mountains. And I was like, okay,
I'm not trying to play it as a negative. My perception of the movie changed in the middle of it, and I thought it was really interesting because I can't remember another time that's happened to me.
Well, I'm not criticizing it because of that either. I'm just saying it's interesting that you brought that up, because it's very rare that I notice something like that, especially on a tiny phone.
Well, I mean, and I noticed it's it because of the way they're doing, you know, you were mentioning.
Yeah, obviously, you know, I mean, you expect
two,
that.
One. All that stuff, like they had it floating behind trees and shit. Clearly, it's digital. did you notice the one like came out from behind a tree?
Yeah, that was cool. The film has a lot of interesting aspects too for horror fans, even if it is kind of an art house type of film or a film that I think might. Co-host Mike, if he was here, probably wouldn't like, because it has some of that art house feel. That I mean, I know he likes art house, but
Mike, it's just something like anything except for zombies and comic book movies.
fair enough. You're probably right. But all in all, it has a religious cult. It has video. The scene is a scene that's kind of reminded me of that clown movie, Eric.
The Eli Roth one. I know that one. When they find the tapes,
The tapes, those tapes were cool. So, and this one, it was like that too. There's a lot of different things in this film that make it have a little bit of everything for all different types of genre fans, I think.
I was also pleasantly surprised by, we're talking about that 20 minute opening. And then
22 minutes.
Oh, wow. And then it goes in a completely direction. In a completely different direction after we get the title screen, and you're like, "Well, what the hell was that about?" Yeah. And I really enjoyed the way they brought it all back around. Like, at one point, he's doing an internet search, and you see the name of the place that they splash on the screen at the beginning of the cold open. And then you actually see a picture of the place later in the movie, too. And then eventually you come back around and see something from that cold open at the end of the movie. And I thought that was really well done, how they tied it all back in. I thought it was really well done.
Agreed.
There was one scene that depressed me very much, because when our lead is talking to the daughter of his friend, mm-hmm. and the daughter of his friend says, 25 years ago, when something happened, and I was thinking, what? That's only 1995. That's not that long ago. But I was like, damn. We're getting old. Crazy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that was just, I don't even want to talk about it. But either way, that was a interesting way transition. And then oddly, the change, even though it was such a great opening, you would think it would slow down and you would lose interest. It's like, oh, what's this? But the intro was so long, it didn't feel like one of those 2 minute, 3 minute ones that we always see in films. And it was really memorable. And then we get a really cool mystery at the beginning. When the movie really starts after the credits, that I think it keeps your attention, even though you kind of ponder and wish that the opening doesn't end, because the opening was just so great. So I felt they began the first act strong enough that it doesn't get weighed down by such a great intro or prologue.
Right. And I thought the atmosphere of this movie was incredible. There's a couple of scenes on a bridge.
Yeah. Fire. There's the fire scene.
I'm an experienced horror movie veteran. Things don't creep me out very easily, but those scenes on – there's even one that's in broad daylight, and they still manage to creep me out a little bit. And I'm like, wow, why is it creeping me out? I don't know. Like, it's just showing an empty road. Why is this creeping me out? I don't understand, but it did. And then later there's a scene in the dark with a bunch of people.
Yeah,
that creeped me the hell out too, and I was just like, oh,
oh my god, yeah,
no. So yeah, I thought the atmosphere of this movie was fantastic.
Go ahead,
and then I'll talk.
All right, I was just gonna say that. After the second act, I was beginning to worry about the film. But then, yeah, that third act where we see the old videotape, that, and then we see the bonfire scene, and all that stuff starts going. It's like, now this is a really good film. This is really good.
Yeah, there was some genuinely really creepy stuff in this that, like you, Eric, I was like, and I'm much more sensitive to it than probably all of you. But still, I'm finding that I'm getting a lot tougher now that I'm watching more stuff. And I was like, oh my god, that is really creepy. Like, that is the kind of creepy that I am not going to forget anytime soon. It's just really disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
Because it wasn't even scary. It was just, like, disturbing.
There's not a heavy reliance on jump scares and stuff. It is more like build up of silence and atmosphere, and also just the unusual sights it presents to you that are very confusing, as they are to the main character, that makes you very uncomfortable. Like, for example, even little things like the woman at the reception desk were very uncomfortable.
Right.
Her expression and stuff like that was just very off and stuff like that. And just,
And there's also all the scenes where somebody's whispering, but you can't hear what they're saying. It's just like
And the way it's done, it almost sounds like, you know, insect legs clicking or just some kind of creature gut making some kind of sound. So it's very unsettling.
Yeah, it really is.
And I absolutely love the design of the strange skeleton in the cavern. That was fucking wild.
Oh, yeah. Well, and then how
we're getting into spoiler territory, so let's be careful.
Well, how they show like one scene early on from his perspective, and then he sees it from a different perspective later on when he learns some things. It's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Oh, and even the file report that talks about a person that it shouldn't be talking about, and it's like, what the?
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah.
Well, and I also thought that there were some really funny moments in here too. Like, not there were moments that I actually laughed in this film.
There were a couple for me too.
A couple, like when he goes, "I'm from San Francisco." Like, that was just like so funny.
Kept saying that too.
Like, that's hilarious.
That was
funny.
And then
he's driving in the car with the creepy fucking bear in the back. I'm like, why would you put the creepy bear in the passenger seat?
All right,
seat
let's
of your
throw
car?
The spoiler flag up.
Oh my god!
Yeah,
we're going there.
Yeah. But I just for a reference of the San Francisco, he's talking about cults and Jonestown. It was just kind of humorous. But yeah, let's throw out the spoiler. So for folks who have not seen this film, you've been warned. We're now going to dissect and critique everything and anything related to the film. For folks who want to see the film prior, they can go see that pretty much anywhere films are available. Myself and Eric, and I'm just guessing, but I'm not really guessing. Eric, as well, I watched it on iTunes.
Eric?
Well, I was going to say, I'm speaking for you without asking, did you watch it on iTunes? But I kind of already knew the answer. And I assume that you bought it too. I'm not sure if you bought it.
I did. Yeah.
Yeah, me too. I did too. So
yeah, I bought it as well.
Yeah, it's only like $10.
Too.
Yeah, I bought it on Amazon.
And I was really happy because I was going to be like, I was thinking, okay, I'm going to spend the $10 and buy this. And if this sucks, I'm going to tell Phil he owes me $10.
No, Eric suggested it.
But I ended up loving it. And I ended up being very happy I spent the $10 because I'm like, dude, I'm totally going to watch this again.
Well, and
like for Horror Fest or having friends over, I'll totally watch this again. So it's good.
From what I've read, this was the very last movie to finish production under Fox Studios before it was acquired by Disney.
Wow.
And Disney did this movie wrong because they put it in theaters in October when really there weren't very many theaters open at that point in time.
No.
Bad time.
And then I guess they just kind of dumped it on digital, but they really didn't do any marketing around it. And really, the only way that you found it is somebody told you about it or you stumbled onto it like I did. So I'm happy we're getting the word out.
Indeed. All right. So the spoiler is up and we can talk about everything and anything. So who wants to start or what do they want to bring up?
Yeah, I want to start because Christy was talking about moments that made her laugh. There was one for me. It's when the guy was talking to what was the character's name? Garrett after he kind of kidnapped him at the
yeah.
cult.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Talking to him, and the guy's just like saying stuff, and he's like, "Where is she?" And he goes, "She's on the bridge." And he goes, "Where's the bridge?" And he goes, "Man, have you even been paying attention? There is no bridge." And he starts laughing maniacally, and the dude just starts beating the shit out of him. And I was just laughing because, like, that would probably be my reaction, too. I thought that was hilarious.
Right, and the scene doesn't make any sense at first, and yet it makes complete sense at the end, what that statement is by that kook.
Yeah, exactly.
He was telling the truth.
Yeah, there is no bridge.
There is no spoon.
Indeed. All right. So, so let's talk about the opening because there's a lot to talk about there. For folks, they say friends, but I think they're couples, you know, a boy girl couples, mm-hmm. and they're doing a hiking mountain type trip through Bhutan. And Bhutan's a very odd country. It's one of those countries that are very isolated. They purposely don't have many relationships with foreign countries. They've actually booted out people as well who've had centuries of generations there, but because they weren't the quote-unquote main ethnicity, those folks have to unfortunately leave. So it's a very, very odd nation. So I was very surprised that we saw four people in Bhutan, because it would be very rare to get access to the country. But either way, they're there to do an interesting trip. And we kind of just dropped in. We don't know much about the four. We don't know why they're there. All we can assume is based off of what we see, which is they're there because they're just adventure type seeker people, you know, the people that would go to Peru and climb that mountain to see that old city that's abandoned in the top.
I'm laughing because my buddy Dan did that a few years ago.
Oh, did he? Okay. Yeah. So you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. So it's those type of people that just want to do something different for vacation rather than going to the, you know, Paris or London or something. And that's pretty much all we know about the folks, right? I mean, talk about it?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is this setup here feels like, you know, something like out of the ritual or something. You know, basically a group of friends gets trapped in some kind of ancient wilderness or some place of, you know, that holds some old relics. So it was, you know, that's why I felt like it could have been its own story. Because we do get some sense of come up, you know, we don't really know them too well, but we get a sense of, you know, who's with who and stuff like that. We get a sense of the atmosphere of this landscape and everything. That's a really cool moment when they're crossing this just fucking rickety ass bridge that honestly just looked like it was going to collapse at any moment. I kept thinking that's going to collapse at some point in this movie. It didn't, but that's where my head was at for first.
Well, yeah, it was definitely the film was definitely trying to trick us into thinking that something very bad was going to happen on this rope bridge.
It's funny is that the main real point where everything kind of starts off with them is at that bridge, and it also ends at that bridge.
Yes.
Yeah, yep. That's a good point. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and it's also interesting too, because that bridge is rickety, but after the film is over, it's almost like you can go back and look at that bridge and go, oh my goodness, that bridge really was a giant metaphor for the entire film, right? Because here's this guy who's this cop, right? And the bridge, of course, symbolizes not only the crossing over an empty space, first of all. I mean, that's what bridges do. But there's also three references in the film to boundaries, very specific references, you know, and a bridge is kind of a way to cross a boundary, basically. But also the way that particular bridge in the opening is constructed, I found it very interesting after the movie was over, because I did watch this movie twice. That it had chain link fence. That was the floor of it.
Yeah.
And that to me represented caged, like the person is caged. So like the cop, he really is in a cage. Like he's imprisoned. He's controlled by them. His life is not his own. And so I could kind of make that leap there. So I thought there were some very subtle things in here, very subtle, that were done to sort of support the story, support the themes, support the thematic statements. And I have to say that, you know, when they're hiking up the mountain and then the one girl like spins the prayer reel almost as a joke, it was interesting because right when the film opens, we hear a clanking, which is a sound that we hear often when it's associated with the emergence or the appearance of this empty man being. And I was almost thinking that maybe the monks had summoned him to get these hikers off the mountain, Phil, in line with what you were saying, because there was the one monk that kind of stares at them. And it's not necessarily ominous, which is good because that would have been too obvious, but he just wasn't staring at them in a very friendly manner.
Right.
And I was almost like, did these monks summon them? And then, of course, they choose the weakest one, who was Paul, because there are references made that Paul's not right.
Right. He has his old scars from his suicide attempts, which ends up being echoed with the character of Amanda, who also has her scars.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. There was so much subtle shit in this film that if you really wanted to look at it and study it, there's a lot going on here. Like, you could definitely write papers about this film for your English class. You totally could, because there's more than enough shit in here to write a paper on.
Anyway. Chrissy, I'm actually even curious if the monks were just similar to the Missouri folk.
That's an interesting thought. They were just
looking for someone else as well, or was the quote unquote weaker guy, whatever his name was he manifested as well?
Oh, the guy Paul?
Yeah. Was
he, I don't right. think so, because he's dying because he can't take the power, and what they do to manifest is so that they have someone that will last longer, is what it sounded like to me.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And all right. So he
had known these people for a long time, so it's not like he just
right, but you gotta remember. Up. But you gotta remember the all of the memories are fake.
That's a fair point.
That's why I was thinking that. Well, but also
the first manifestation of this happens in that old cave, which makes you think that was the original vessel that was, you know, hidden away.
Right. Well, that vessel definitely wasn't human, right? It was like
No way.
Yeah, it was like some sort of merged bones or something.
What, you don't know anybody with eight arms?
unless they built it, you know what I mean?
Well, that's what I'm saying.
It was more of a like a an idol.
Altar.
Yeah. It's an interesting country because it does have 75% is Buddhist, but 25% are Hindu. So it could have something to do with Hindu gods as well. But again, this movie doesn't really talk about religion much, so it's more of like a cult. So we don't really know where or what the being comes from. As Eric mentioned, it's kind of like in the dark and the wicked. We don't know the why necessarily. I am kind of wondering if the monks weren't just pissed or annoyed at these people, but they saw an opportunity to have a new host.
To get rid of it.
Yeah.
Maybe even.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, it's your problem. It's your problem now.
Well, and here's the thing is that we don't get a lot of those answers as to what the purpose is, as to what they're trying to accomplish, as to the why. But the reason that I don't think this is supernatural is because if we were to believe everything that's said in this movie, this is all done with the power of the mind. And I have a, like, to me, supernatural means like other realms, you know, demons from hell, ghosts from the beyond. To me, that's supernatural. This is, if it's done with the power of the mind, that to me doesn't really say supernatural. I don't know what you want to call it. I hesitate to call it science fiction too, because what's the science?
Metaphysical, maybe.
Metaphysical. That's a decent word for it.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's why I hesitate to call it supernatural.
That's fair. I get that. And like I said, I think there were a couple of Poe moments there too. There were actually a couple of moments during the film where, before I even knew what the ending was at all, the first time I watched it, where I was like, is this shit all in this guy's head? Like, there were a couple of obvious things to me, or maybe it's just because I do read a lot of stuff where it's all in the person's head, you know, kind of like the yellow wallpaper. I read a lot of shit like that, and Edgar Allan Poe does a lot of that stuff. And so maybe I'm just used to picking up on things that other people wouldn't. For example, the pills. That was obvious to me. I'm like, oh, okay, he's popping pills. And we don't know what for until the end when it says doxepin, which is actually an antidepressant that's used to treat insomniacs. But I was like, what are those pills? Like, I know there's something, but I don't know what they're for. I mean, I didn't want to assume depression. Just because, even though they said, you know, his wife and his kid had died, I was like, okay, they could be for depression. But even if they were, there is a chance that he could be on something that's creating hallucinations.
Well, there's that's always for that actual chance. Depression, sleep deprivation, depression, where you can't sleep because you're depressed, and then they give you that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But what I'm saying is, before we know that, we don't know that until the very end of the film, what he's actually taking. They don't show us the actual name of the shit.
Oh, yeah.
Until
yeah.
the end. So I had no, once I saw the end, I was like, okay, yeah, doxepin probably wouldn't do that to you. Because I've been on it and I know what it is. But,
though, how when he opens up the medicine cabinet, we see that shot from behind the medicine cabinet, how he's got his wedding ring right next to the medication.
Yes, that
yeah.
was very
that
well
was a nice
done,
touch.
Yeah. Very nice touch. And then when he doesn't take that last pill, you know, he does not take the pill at the end, right before all the shit hits the fan, you know, the wedding ring, he puts it back on, which I thought was really interesting, because we have this whole kind of subtle thing going on with carrying the guilt because his wife and his kid died. You know, this is right before you find out that all these memories probably aren't real anyway. So you believe them. But I thought that was interesting, because it's almost like, okay, I am ready to move on now. I am ready to stop grieving. I'm ready to climb out of my depression. And a wedding band, while it represents unity and a continuous, you know, a unity between two individuals, there's a lot of things it represents. I'm not even going to talk about that. It'll take all night. But it can also represent a cyclicalness, like everything coming back around full circle. And I thought, then we saw the ending, and I thought, oh, that's really interesting that he put his wedding ring back on, because that kind of ties into the idea of the full circle. You know, these cult people are going to get a new god now, so the cycle will continue. So I don't know. That's a way that wedding ring connects to it. It connects to the guilt in the life that he believed was real, but it also connects to the overall, as a symbol, it connects to the overall cult and, you know, what they're trying to do. So I just thought that was kind of interesting.
So after he was became the vessel, that's when he put on the wedding ring?
No, it was right before the end.
Right before, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Because
right before he goes into the hospital. So it's kind of, yes, symbolic of him if it coming full circle, like Chrissy's saying.
Yeah, also of him to show that he has humanity, even though the cult claims he has no humanity.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah,
because,
a lot of shit going on in this movie. Of shit.
What very interesting is, a lot of when we get deeper into the world of this cult, we kind of see these people who will try to join it, being stripped down of individuality. First, we see all these people with various backgrounds and stuff like that at the auditorium and sitting down for the, you know, the session, stuff like that. Then there's one point where he's walking through the bunks and stuff like that, and he sees a group of them sitting down in front of this black painting, all their heads shaved, you can't see their faces, and all whispering. You can't tell them apart. Then you get
I thought you were done.
Then you get, of course, to the fire pit where everybody's in a dark hood and stuff like that, moving in unison like a group of ants. So you get the complete sense that everyone is just kind of merging into nothing.
What I was going to say is that I don't know if you noticed or not, but that black painting was also in the rooms of the girls that he was looking for earlier in the movie.
I think so. Yeah, I recall that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I did notice that. And also, it's interesting that you bring up the ants, Abe, because in that very opening scene, when they descend into the cave,
there's little
ants. You see these little ants crawling all over.
Yep.
So that kind of foreshadows what these people are. And And oh my God, that I know we're jumping way ahead, but that fucking scene, I can't wait to talk about that scene around the fire because that was so fucked up.
Oh, it was
anyway,
awesome.
It was fucking amazing. That is one of the best scenes I've ever seen in a horror movie. Seriously, that was so amazing.
Yeah, and for me, don't ask me why. Anytime I see those creepy old videotape things that are just like not right, they show that they just bother me and they're scared.
Like the Ring.
Yeah, that's what it made me think of was the Ring. Yeah.
Oh, even
you know what? It kind of reminded me a little bit of Faces of Death too, for whatever reason. The way it was shot, it totally looked like something out of Faces of Death. I was like, shout out to the Gen Xers. Here we go.
You're talking about the fire scene. There's one moment in there where all of those cultists at the same time take two steps forward, and I got goosebumps. I was just like,
yep.
Oh fuck. And then the character says something along the lines of, oh no, uh-uh, and turns around and starts running. I'm just like, that's right, buddy, you get your ass out of there.
Yeah, it was a solid third act.
Yeah
Yeah, it was pretty awesome.
And I will say there were some little trope nods in here too that they just fucked with that were fabulous. Like, and they're very subtle. Like, he keeps waking up at 3 a.m. and you think it's just a tropey thing. Like, oh, look, they're doing a nod to the magical number 3 a.m, the witching hour, all this. But then at the end of the movie, it's 3 o'clock at night. When they all turn to him and sink to him, like when he shoots the dude or whatever, it's in the clock in the hospital.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So right. That was kind of cool.
I like how he's really practical throughout too. Like he, when they start stamping their feet and then start running towards me, fuck this, and he runs. Yeah.
Smart move.
Yeah, well, what's interesting about this character is he never really comes undone.
No,
like he doesn't really start to fall apart. He really keeps the shit together. And I think that's very interesting, particularly because we are dealing with a person that we believe in the beginning of the movie is very compromised by grief and loss and all of this. And so for him to keep his shit together, we see what a good cop he must have been. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, and to get back to the first act, it's an interesting first act because the movie is a mystery of the first act. Basically, we have this ex-police officer, James LaSombra, who is a widower. His wife and child died in a car accident. And his friend's daughter, his friend Nora, her daughter, Amanda, disappears. And so he decides to do the private eye thing for Nora to try to find out what's going on with the daughter, because the police, as usual, say, well, we have to wait 24 hours. She's 17 or 18, so she's apt to have just, you know, gone off maybe to the big city to party for a few days, and you'll hear from her in a week. But, of course, the mother doesn't think that, and James obviously says, "Yeah, you're right. They're not going to do anything for you, so I'll help you out," because he's good friends with Nora. And since we're in spoiler territory, he's had an affair with Nora while he was married. Yeah. So he's very close to Nora, and that's the beginning. And then we meet Amanda's friends. The whole first act is very brooding, melancholy, I felt. It really fills the atmosphere really cool. Now, yeah. Babe, go on.
There's also a real sense of loneliness in there too. You know, aside from the moments where our main character James and Nora are together, he's mostly by himself throughout this thing, just his lone figure moving between this. I guess it was just this very empty world in a way. I don't know how to explain it. It's like, even though there's people around and stuff like that, he hardly interacts with too many other folks and stuff like that. So he's kind of like floating in a way.
Right.
Well,
right.
And interestingly enough, like the people who matter the most to him in this movie, I don't know if they do they exist? Because his whole backstory was implanted, right?
Yeah,
he's only been in existence for 3 days. So
I think they existed.
Did the sun ever exist? Is Nora real?
Oh.
I don't think so.
I think the mother's real. I think that she used parts of the real story. It's the feeling I got, but maybe not. Maybe it is all just.
How did he get married, have a kid, and an affair in 3 days?
He did it. It was all memories that were created.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
So like
his interactions with the police officers and the cult members and the teenage girls at the school, I think those were all real, but I think the other stuff was not.
Right. The everything from the birthday coupon at the diner forward is real. Anything that happened in his past where he looks back or he talks about things isn't real, because it's like the Westworld, the mm-hmm. clones there are robots. They have all these fake, things.
Because how is no real if he had no wife and had no kid and had no affair with her?
Yeah, like the police part.
But this is what Eric's getting at, and I think, and you could be right, is even though he was created with that coupon, I still don't know if a lot of the stuff after that is actually true too, because you're right, because he never interacted necessarily with Nora in the first place, because she doesn't even know who the hell he is.
Right.
So,
but yet he seems to interact with the cop, and the cop seems to know who he is, but that must be just an implanted memory too. So we have a totally unreliable narrator that we can't trust at all.
Oh, very, very.
Right. And
right.
That's part of the whole Poe of this.
Actually, I think everything is fake, because the kid says there is no bridge. So there was probably none of those kids suicided. There was no bridge for them to suicide on. So none of it was real.
Right.
We're not real. Nothing's real. Podcast is not real.
So the question is,
something are real.
When did he become sentient about himself? Because he was created when he used the coupon, but none of the memories from the coupon to when he's talking to Amanda actually ever happened, is my guess, because there is no bridge.
Mm-hmm. Well, they implanted all the memories of the funeral, though, that they were at, obviously, where they ended up having sex afterwards.
Yeah, and that was fake, too. Yeah, because Nora doesn't even know who the hell he is.
Right.
And there's no bridge for the wife to have gone off of.
Or no spoon.
Right.
Well, I think, too, kind of along these lines, too, where, you have this theme of, again, perception versus reality, I think, is a running theme in this.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that they kind of dropped in the cold opening, and I was looking for, was, again, to show back up again, was, if you touch me, you'll die.
All right.
If you touch me, you'll die. And I kept looking through the movie to see where that was going to show up. And then I realized it was very clever. It did show up, but it did not show up in a literal way. And that's kind of why I really liked how this film took tropes and messed with them. Because in a lesser movie, you would be hearing that phrase over and over. And here they give it to you a couple times in the opening, and then that's it. It's there in the movie. You just don't see it as much. One of the places it's very obvious is, where he has sex with her, that implanted memory of him having sex, that carnal knowledge, the touch, if you touch me, you'll die. Right.
Right.
He fires
a little death.
A little death, right, exactly. And then there's another point where he, like, you know, he shoots the guy at the end. You know, he shoots the hiker at the end. That Paul, because, you know, he shoots him at the end. If you touch me, you'll die. And that is right before he assumes what Paul used to be. So he touches him, even though it's not, hi, I put my hand on your ass. Like, it's like he touches him through the gunshot. So, and I'm sure there's other places in there. Like I said, I'd have to really go watch it again to get them all, because I'm pretty sure there was more than just those two that I picked up on. There's probably more. I just didn't get them all. But yeah, so I thought that was interesting, because I sat here and I went, oh man, they dropped the ball on that. You know, they give you this thing in the opening, if you touch me, you'll die, you know, and you're waiting for it to come back. And it did come back, just not the way we expected. And I thought that was brilliantly done. Very well done.
Right.
The part of the movie that left me wanting a little bit was the, like you said, Chris, he kills this guy to take his place, and the cultists start basically worshiping him. And I guess I don't understand. I would like to almost see a sequel on this, or a prequel or something.
They are talking about a sequel.
That would be pretty cool, because I would like to know. I would like to know where this all started, and like clearly the whole thing is here is thoughts are being transmitted and they're communicable. So what are the thoughts that are being transmitted? Why are they being transmitted? What is the purpose of the transmission? That is all the stuff that they did not explain here that I would like to know.
Which transmissions again?
Huh?
The thought transmissions. The way the empty man is created and everything.
Oh, how it happens.
No, why it happens.
Why, yeah.
Clearly, they just manifested him, right? Through the power of their minds. That's how he was created.
Amanda kind of explains it, doesn't she? She says they needed a body to hold the empty man that wouldn't feel like Paul. And they created all the fake memories for she gave the...
No, I get all that. Okay. What I'm saying is... Paul was created to take the empty man, right, so he could transmit the thoughts. That's what Paul was doing, right?
I thought it was because he was just a normal human. He couldn't hold it as long because they said he was in the hospital for 23 years.
I think you're all missing my point here. There is something. Let's not even call it a man. But whatever Paul is, okay, he was transmitting thoughts, right? Remember Amanda called him the carrier?
Okay.
Because he's carrying the transmission, all right? And it's very important to this cult about these communicable thoughts being transmitted. And eventually, our main character takes his place to be the empty man, to be the one transmitting these thoughts.
Right.
What they don't tell us is what those thoughts are that are being transmitted and why the cult wants that to happen. Those are the answers I'd like to know.
Oh, okay, I get it. I understand what you're saying now, Eric.
I get two things. The first one is, we don't know the thoughts. The second one, and this is just an assumption, is to do bad things.
That is just an assumption.
Bad things and why? See, those are all the answers that I want.
You know, Eric, you were saying that this isn't really like supernatural or really like science fiction. And I was thinking it reminds me of Scientology, which has a little bit of both. The cult reminds me of that. It's got a little bit of that alien from outer space thing to it, and a little bit of supernatural, and then this power of the mind. That's exactly what it made me think of with Scientology.
Maybe. I'm just saying, it didn't give us that information, and I would like it.
And we are not here to denounce anyone's faith. So any hatred.
Well, as a devout Scientologist, and will not put up for this shit.
I'm not a Scientologist. However, for our Scientologist listeners, we have no public opinion of your religion or anybody else's.
Phil does not have any public opinion.
But I will say, it actually kind of reminded me a little bit, Barrett, with Lovecraftian stuff, where
that too
humans are just vessels to use. They're not important to
for the greater beings.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, and I'm sure that the people that made this movie Or actually, you know what? It's based on a graphic novel. I haven't read that, so I don't know if it's taken directly from there or not. But whoever created the story ultimately did on purpose not giving us those answers. They either didn't have them or didn't want to give them to us. So
Well, the question is it's a series of comic books. So is there further comic books or graphic novels, if you prefer, that go into those things? And that's a good question. I don't know. There may be if you know, there as rumors that before the film was released and it unfortunately didn't become successful because of Disney's complete screw up of the release. There were supposed to be possible sequels had this movie done well, that it makes me wonder if, yeah, there must be other additions to the series that didn't make it to the film. Mm-hmm. That would possibly explain those things, Eric, but that's a good question. Now, I know if Mike was here, he would say, well, then it should have been in the film, because you have to if it's not in the film and you're not going to explain it, then that's bad filmmaking. But again, if they were planning to make it as a sequel, it should stand alone, Mike would say. But it's a fair point. So Mike has a fair point, even though I'm just channeling
him. Mike lives in Phil's head, and he's having an argument with himself.
Indeed. So technically, it should be, but should stand alone. However, as a devil's advocate to the bike in my brain, I will say this, which is not all things have to be answered.
Well, and no, and I'm not saying that it ruins the movie at all. I'm just saying it got me interested, and I'd like to know more.
Sure. Yeah. And the guy that wrote the graphic novel, he's also written parts of Deadpool, X-Men, among other things. So he's listed as all these other things even before we get to The Empty Man, and yet The Empty Man may be probably his most important work if we look at it in a critical sense. So I don't know. That's a really good question. I would love to know what they're transmitting. Yeah, yes. And that's what makes it sound more science fiction-y to me.
Yeah.
You know, but that's the thing. It's like a merge of science fiction and supernatural, you know, and it has the cult thing and all that. So it's just interesting because that's how Lovecraft was too. You know, he had the cult and these quote unquote devil worshiper people, but they're actually worshiping like Cthulhu and stuff. And yet Cthulhu and all those things are considered science fiction-y because they're coming from an alternate dimension and stuff, which is through science, not through the mysticism.
Yeah, under the sea, in the ocean, different portals and stuff like that. And, you know, it's, yeah, there's attempts to kind of tie, in a way, ground this, even though it is very fantastical at the same time.
Right.
And you know what? I just had something occur to me. I'm sorry. I've got to spit it out before it leaves my brain. I think the teenage girls were real because the one that dies in the sauna, he's not around. So he's not narrating that part. We just see it happen.
Right. That's true.
Good point.
Yeah. I'm just saying there is enough unreliable narrator here, and there is enough things, like particularly at the end when he goes back to his house and it's empty. You know, there's just enough that you could.
I get what you're saying.
Let me ask you this.
It's possible. It's not probable, but you could make it work.
Don't they have a funeral or some sort of vigil for the death of the girl in the sauna? Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, but they didn't for the other students that suicided on the bridge.
Didn't they? I thought it was all one and the same.
I thought it was the same.
Okay, all right. Then what that means then is I don't think any of it happened because there is no bridge.
So then how did we see the girl in the sauna bite it when the unreliable narrator is not there to narrate it?
That is the only thing that I can't answer. That's a really good question.
Yeah, I'm wondering if that's maybe a fuck up. You know, I mean, it's just like in a short story, sometimes you have a hole in there and you don't realize you have a hole in there. Maybe that's a hole.
It's weird because it's also the one moment where we actually see the empty man kill somebody directly.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, directly.
The actual being. The creature being. Yeah, we do. That is true.
I don't think it was a physical being.
But still, it was the first time
it lifted her. It lifted her.
Yeah.
Right?
She was at, because yeah, then we switch and we see that she's actually the one stabbing herself.
No. Right, but Eric, it cuts away when we see she's stabbing herself. There is a cut there where it's in the thing's hand, and then suddenly it's in her hand.
Uh-huh.
It's a very clever cut. Right. So I'm kind of going to go with they might have fucked up on this because they never show the actual creature kill anybody except for that girl, and that is definitely inconsistent with every
other. And how was even though it was her killing that, herself?
Yeah.
How was she picked up a foot off the ground?
Yeah, they actually show her.
Wasn't that was an illusion in her head?
And maybe the empty man is the narrator.
that's
good. That's good. If that would explain it.
So otherwise, to our listeners, if it turns out that we all show up dead, don't blow into any bottles.
Indeed. And yet, you know what?
Who is doing that? Oh, my God. You're going to give me fucking nightmares.
And even that being the case, there were no bottles. Because there was no bridge.
Well,
hey,
you know
there was a bottle in the first 22
right
minutes.
Now.
First
no,
22 minutes,
be no
there was
bottles
a bottle.
In my house in about
no,
five
no,
minutes.
No, it was the whistle. It was the archaic bone whistle that Abe was referring to. It wasn't a bottle.
Yeah, but it sounded like it. And I thought that was really cool. And I have to give props to that moment in the opening where she looks out and the reveal of the creature in the snow.
That was cool.
That was really beautiful. I was like, damn, that is terrifying. Terrifying.
Then it's not an unreliable narrator. Because somebody else who wasn't affected saw it.
Was she affected?
Well, she blew on it. That's the thing. She actually blew on the thing. Remember, she was sitting there with Paul, and she blew on the flute. And so that's when you get the first night you hear it, right? Then the second time you see it, then the third night it touches you. And then it did eventually touch her, right? Because she was killed, in the end of that opening.
Well, it's also because the Paul transmitted when he whispered into her ear.
Yeah.
Mm, okay.
Yeah, he definitely whispered because it's somehow contagious, right? A little bit.
It's an earworm.
Yeah. Well, I think the empty man is real.
Oh, yeah, because he goes into Paul at the end. So the empty man does exist, absolutely. Yeah.
But I don't know. See, this whole thing just, you can get spooked.
Well, basically, the cult is real. I mean.
Yeah.
But basically, we got the 22 minutes to begin, and that is most likely real. And then the last 10 minutes. But between minute 23 all the way to 2 hours and 7 minutes never happened.
I disagree.
Well, some of that happened, like anything with the cult where they were doing things, those things were happening. Not when Paul was there, though. I mean, not Paul, the cop, ex-cop, what's his name?
I forget his name.
James Lambrose. Yeah, because he's summoned by them. I think that was real. Yeah, like maybe. The whole scene where they're sitting in a circle in the cult room and they're calling and they hear him.
Oh, okay.
That's right. Real.
Yeah.
Stuff like that is what I'm talking about.
Actually, you're right. I think the third act was all real.
Because that's when he's doing his research and he's finding out that he's fake.
Yeah. Like the folder with nothing in it. I love that. They're fucking.
Yeah. And then the folder where he's naked in a chair and he doesn't have the memory of him being naked in a chair. And it's like, what the fuck? Yeah. And then the tape,
when they attempted the first time and it failed. And that was that like freaky guy.
Oh, that fucking bear. Oh my God. Oh. What the fuck is up with that bear? That's horrifying. I don't know why.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I said that before we were talking about spoilers earlier. It made me laugh when he goes and he picks up the creepy bear. And then in the next scene, he's sort of tailing like the dudes from the Institute or whatever. And they show a shot of him in the car and he's got the fucking bear in the backseat. I'm like, what the fuck? I just started laughing because it was funny to me. I was like, that is really funny. Like, what is the deal with this bear? Yeah. And the fact that it is a bear that has nothing to do with anything. Like,
well,
it's
it makes
not,
me wonder, did he put it simple... back there? Did he put it back there or did it just follow him?
Oh, so, that's creepy.
So unbearable. So
creepy, dude.
Oh!
But honestly, the bear does not exist.
It does not.
Because the bridge does not exist. But honestly, yeah, so I think you may be right, Barrett. The third act is all real. But acts one and two were all fake memories.
I still don't buy it. There's some of it that's real.
Some of it. Yeah, it's hard to parse out what's real, what's
yeah.
not.
It's difficult problem. To draw the lines, for sure. Yeah. But I think the stuff with the teenage girls actually happened.
Like, she wrote the story. Some of it was probably based on reality for her. So it's a story of his memory and things she experienced.
Mm-hmm. Well, but, Paul was her dad. Paul what? Was that.
Paul was Amanda's dad. That's interesting. Yeah, you're probably right.
Yeah, because no, they showed it very obviously with the beard when he was laying there. And if you look at the pictures in the house.
Yes, the pictures in the house are of him. Yeah.
And
yeah.
that's another
pictures. I didn't put that together.
Yeah, yep. They were his pictures. Yep.
They were his pictures. And here's another interesting thing about that. There is a lot done in the beginning of this film with first of all, the backstory sort of filled in with images. So that parallels sort of the idea of the fake memories they're planting in his brain. But also what's interesting about that is we kind of see it's this whole idea of loss and these things that are perception versus reality. Like, was I really there? And anytime you're in someone's home in this movie, there are close-ups of certain pictures, or they seem to make sure that there are pictures in the certain shots, like framed photos. And I think that definitely contributed to the themes. But also, that's how I figured out Paul was her dad. Because and they made a big deal of her trimming his beard at the end and all that. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I went, oh my God, that was him. I was not crazy. That was his picture.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was seeing. Yeah.
Cool.
But it's but really Nora, done in such a dream way that it's hard to notice.
Exactly.
But is Amanda actually Nora's daughter or not then? Because Nora doesn't know who James is. And if she doesn't know who James is, she wouldn't know who Paul is.
No, this is where I think that her reality is being used to help shape his story, because that's her mom, but she's utilizing her in the story to as his love affair.
All right, but the mom would know about James because she would be part of the cult that metaphysically created James.
Mom's not part of the cult at all.
So the mom doesn't know her daughter or ex-husband were cultists then.
That's what I think.
I don't think she does know.
Yeah.
She has no idea. And again, she in some way, remember, she's like, I'm sorry, I don't remember you. It just goes to show you that the cult also probably has control over her mind too.
Right. Well, maybe
that's kind of the way I took it. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's how I kind of figured it out.
I can buy that too.
I don't think Paul was ever consciously involved with the cult. He just became
became a vessel.
Right, exactly.
As Nora knows he died on that trip.
Right,
exactly.
Right. So, but yeah, I when you say the teenage girls, do you mean the boys and girls that suicided on the bridge, Eric?
Yes.
Okay, well, they couldn't have suicide on the bridge, because there is no bridge.
The bridge is metaphorical.
Yeah.
There's a physical bridge.
There is a physical bridge, yeah.
So
it has a bridge in it.
Right, because she used the bridge in his story. There's just no bridge for him.
Right. Okay, if that's the case, then everything after... that can't be. I was going to say everything after the diner scene with the gift certificate still couldn't have happened because he had never had an interaction with Nora, because she doesn't know who he is, nor did he ever have interaction with the cops, because the cops said, we knew you were a cop once, but he never was a cop because he didn't exist, and they can't create memories.
That's the part I can't figure out. But
all right, so that's the reason why I'm saying that there is no bridge. Actually, even physically, there's no bridge.
I think that's false.
Because
bridge.
What I'm thinking is everything up to when he does.
You're trying to draw clean lines, Phil, and I don't think there are clean lines here.
Yeah. You could probably look at every single scene and there's part that's real and part that's not.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. That's a fair thing. Yeah. All right.
And I think that's purposeful. They want it to be that confusing.
Right. Right.
Oh, they definitely do. They definitely do. And that's one of the reasons why I think you're either going to be a person who loves this movie or does not like it, because it is not a popcorn movie. It is not a let's go. It's not a bye-bye man. You know, it's not a Slender Man even, which we all know is crap. But still, it's not one of those movies. It is one of these movies that is meant to make you kind of think. It's meant to be vague. It's meant to be ambiguous. And in some ways, it's really geniusly done, because depending on the experience that you bring to it, you could justify like a bunch of different ways this goes in your head that works for you. You know?
And I think what you said was right, Chrissy, that this is the one that got it right.
Opposed
to Bye Bye Man and the Slender Man. And it's unfortunate that like the poster art on this movie totally makes you think it's one of those. So like when I went to watch this the first time, I was like, I don't know. Is it going to be another one of these?
Yeah.
But luckily it's not. It's like you said, they got this one right.
Yeah, this is a film that kind of got poorly misrepresented. And I think that's why it got, you know, some mixed reviews. You know, that seems to happen in a lot of movies. Is just don't get their identity made straight to the in marketing.
Right. Well, the film, though, I mean, it's definitely not going to be for everybody.
Oh, no. But
it was definitely marketed wrong. I did read that they originally had test audiences watch it when Disney bought it. And then they took all those Fox films and they started doing the test audiences to see opinions. And this got horrible reviews by the test audience. So they panicked and they pulled the plug on the film. And I think when they finally decided to release it, they said, hey, let's just make it look like it's some teen horror film, like, you know, Slender Man or Bye Bye Man.
And for me, this fits in with Hereditary. I mean, that's, you know.
Yes, I agree. It doesn't go, I don't think it pulls the emotional strings that like a Hereditary or a Midsummer does.
Well,
it does not manipulate your emotions as well.
I think it's more like It Follows or something like that.
I could see it being in the same category with Hereditary or It Follows or Deliver Us From Evil. I mean, to me, it's just, the way it's structured is very much like Deliver Us From Evil. And there's a lot of similarities and it shares the same. The positive qualities in Deliverance from Evil are shared by this one. You know, if you kind of watch them back to back, like I am, the next Horror Fest I have with my cousin, we're going to watch Deliverance from Evil again since we haven't seen it in a number of years and I own it. And then I want to sit down and watch this. And I just want to see, because I just got that feel to it. I just felt like this is really good. This is like Deliverance from Evil, which is one of my favorite, films of that, you know, kind of ilk. But yeah, and that's sad too, because I don't know about you guys, but I don't always trust these studios with their test audiences.
No.
Sometimes I'm like, well, people, they didn't like it. Okay, who did you show it to? Soccer moms? Because, yeah, that's not going to work. You know?
I don't trust them.
I don't
kind of understand them. The test audience thing, but at the same time, I don't like. It's just like, it depends on who's involved with the project. Like, if this is a studio project and Disney is making this, you know, what, Aladdin sequel, whatever the hell, and it's their property and they want to make sure it hits right, fine, go do your test audience and make it what you want. But if this is a project that's headed by somebody else, like if there's a director that has a vision for a project, and they're writing the script and directing the movie and they have a clear vision of what it's supposed to be, I think trying to divert that is folly and very rarely will it do anything other than make it worse.
I absolutely 100% agree.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 100%. Well, and that was the problem with this film, is that it was made by a big studio when this is would have been one of those perfect films that was made indie, you know, like most of the horror films that we've seen this year that are pretty good, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because then it wouldn't have gotten a bad word of mouth, it wouldn't have had the bad test audience. What it would have done is it would have gone to, you know, genre festivals, and then it would get buzzed through the festivals, and then people would want to see it, you know, similar to like Hereditary, you know, and that's how those films became popular. It wasn't because a Hollywood budget made them. It was someone smaller made them, and they were picked up by a small release company, brought it to festivals, and it immediately got this huge buzz, and then they became super films like It Follows, Hereditary, whatever. And this film should have been that, but unfortunately, Disney screwed the whole thing up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Indeed.
Well, and you know, I mean,
well,
my personal opinion of Disney lately on all fronts is that they have been screwing up so much shit that they really have been screwing stuff up. You know, a lot, on a lot of levels. They've been screwing up the parks. It doesn't surprise me that they're going to start screwing up all their films. They've been super buying to the point now where, I mean, I don't know. You know what?
Any organization, when it gets to be big enough, starts to collapse under its own weight.
It's absolutely coming.
They're going on a creative monopoly of everything, you know, of any property they get their hands on. And a lot of times they don't know what the fuck they're doing with it. They're just like, oh, this is a popular brand. It's well known enough. It shouldn't be too hard to get some cash out of this.
And then they screw authors like Alan Dean Foster out of their money.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. They need to keep their hands off horror. They've already messed up their own parks. They've already screwed up Star Wars. They've already screwed up a whole bunch of stuff. You know what? They just need to stop now. And when the day comes when it all falls on their heads, I'm going to laugh, because it's coming. And they have had this happen to them before in the past, and they never learn. It's like every 20 years they do the same stupid shit, and then it destroys.
That is
true.
That is true.
And then they go, oh, no, this is terrible. And then they spend all this time trying to get their shit back together, and then in 20 years they're doing it all over again. They're like stupid. I don't get it. Like, how many times are you going to hit your head against the wall and realize that the window isn't going to open for you? Like, you know, there's always going to be a window there. It's like my cat, you know, jumping and hitting the window all day long.
Right. Yeah. And that's unfortunate. Again, though, based off of, you know,
they really screwed this up. Yeah.
Yeah. And based off the type of film it is, obviously it wasn't going to be a mass marketed type film anyway. So you could even argue, why did Fox decide to do it, unless they were going to release it under their, like,
Searchlight.
Yeah, exactly. That's all I could think of. But it doesn't seem like they were going to. So I don't know. Maybe they thought this was going to be a oh, it's by the guy that did X-Men and the guy that did all those comic book stuff, Deadpool. So yeah, that maybe this will work. It'll be a great film. All the kids that likes will see it in January for, like, Slender Man, you know. And mm-hmm. I think that's all I can think, you know. But all in all,
Decision to dump it in theaters in October is what really just baffles me. It's like, what? That, yeah, like
during COVID when there was no
theaters. Talk about giving a movie no chance. It could not have been successful under those circumstances.
Nope.
Right.
Well, so they just decided F this movie.
Yeah. Well, and they did have a problem, and it's not because of the acting's horrible, because the acting's excellent, but they don't have any big star in it, so it wasn't like you know, for example, that Kevin Bacon movie mm-hmm. with Amanda Seyfried.
That's a marketing problem. I'm just talking logistically. Yeah. When 75% of the theaters in the nation are closed, you're just boning a movie if you only give it a theatrical release at that point.
Right. But I think maybe because it doesn't have the actor, though, that's why they decided to not just release it direct to video, like the Nicholas Willy's Wonderland or You Should Have Left, because both of those were supposed to be big feature films in October of last year. Because of COVID, they said, all right, we can't do it, we're going to push them back. And then they said, hey, you know what, let's they have big actors in it, let's drop them on VOD and make money. And they did, you know. But this one, they should have done that, which is they should have just dropped it on VOD and made money instead of put it at theaters. But I think they must have panicked. Oh, shoot, we don't have Nicolas Cage. Oh, shoot, we don't have Kevin Bacon or Amanda Seyfried. What do we do? And they said, well, we'll just take the loss.
Yeah, that's what it came down to. That's
the calculations that are bad. Yeah, take the loss.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, James Badge deal is excellent in the film. And the girl, the woman, Marin Ireland, she's really good. Everybody else is really good. But, again, there's no name actors, and the Disney freaks out, and they decide to quote unquote release it at theaters. It's like, what? And I don't know. I think they could have made some money if they had brought it to VOD earlier this year, like in January, like when you saw it, Eric, and just released it then and high profile, or try to make it high profile, you know. I don't know, but you know, they could have said that from the creators of Deadpool and X-Men. You know, and they didn't even do that. So, so it's a shame. It's a shame.
So, we have anything else to say about this movie?
Yeah.
Let's talk question. About the bonfire.
No. Oh, okay.
Bonfire scene. We didn't. Really talk
about that. I think we really need to talk about that bonfire scene, because that was just amazing. So, Eric, I think somebody, or Eric, or one of you, just needs to describe what actually happens to the listeners so that they know what we're talking about.
So basically, James finally figures out that there is a camp where basically people are continuing the brainwashing and the indoctrination into the cult. This is where he finds some bits of evidence, such as the videotapes we mentioned earlier, and some files and stuff like that, and weird shit. And as he's making his way out, it's nightfall at this point, he sees a whole group of people, a large group of people, going around this fire. They're almost like marching in unison. And then they're sometimes slowed down, sometimes they speed up, and suddenly they start to go faster and faster around this fire. And he's in a trance watching this as the fire actually begins to climb and climb until it becomes like a pillar. And suddenly, as it feels like something else is going to happen, everything stops. He kind of comes back to reality, and the fire has not, it didn't seem like it had ever climbed in the first place, until he realizes the cult is looking at him. All these figures are watching him. He's been seen, and so he slowly starts to step back a few times, but so do the cultists as they move forward towards him. Each step he takes back, they move forward, until he realizes he has to get out, and that's when he's like, no, and he bolts, and so all these cultists, like a swarm of hungry black ants, come running down the hill towards him through the woods, and they're screaming and hollering after him as he's trying to bolt, get into his vehicle, and they're smashing bottles and climbing into his car, and he just tries to peel the fuck out of there as fast as he can. And it's a very intense fucking scene.
Any commentary on what that you thought when you saw it? Bear, what did you think of this when this was going on?
It was just a very captivating scene, just watching it. I mean, I felt like I was being captivated into the fire as I was watching it and pulled into the movie. It was just a great view. And then when they just start turning around and the fire has gone out and he starts backing up and he makes a tad bit of noise and they start moving forward and then he runs and they run. It's an amazing scene.
I thought it was visually scrumptious. There was the stars, which were just amazing, and then there was the fire, and then after the fire goes out, and then there were the stadium lights, and the whole thing was just a visual feast.
Yeah, it's really mesmerizing.
That stadium light winks out was just, my heart stopped.
Yeah, and that, you know, it's one of the big set pieces of the film. It's like really all built up so well to that moment.
Also, I felt really uncomfortable prior to that scene because we had the old videotape scene literally right before this scene, and so I was already in that horror mode, you know, fright mode, and I felt that from that whole third act was just like nonstop. It made me feel like creepy, similar to how the first A Quiet Place made me have my heart race. You know?
Yeah.
It was really, really intense, sure. Yeah. For folks that are curious, because we're already in spoiler. But basically, what's going on for people who are still confused? Because again, the movie is confusing, even critics. And Eric mentioned things are unanswered. But what's going on is there's an entity called the Empty Man that we don't know why or what it is or why it's there or what its goals are, and people for some reason worship it. And what happens, it needs a host. And the prior host was Paul from Tibet, Bhutan, where he was on his vacation there, and it encompasses his soul, as we said, because he was probably the weakest, and the monks had something to do with it, most likely. And yet the body's failing. And so what the cult is doing is they decide to, rather than use another body that they're just going to have to replace every 20 years or so, they come up with this metaphysical idea where they somehow figure out through, you know, call it magic, call it science, call it quantum physics, whatever you want to call it, that they can create using memories. And I forget the term they use.
Equation that they show is,
what's the term they use?
Thought plus time plus concentration equals flesh.
And there was a term they used that's actually a term in the Buddhist religion, and I looked it up yesterday when I watched the film.
Tulpa. Yeah, they showed it on the Wikipedia page.
And so what that does is that you can create based off of this equation using this religious thing, tulpa. Create things out of thin air. And so what they do is they create a body out of thin air to use as the host, the new host for the Empty Man. But that body, which is the body we see in that weird video, doesn't work. And it like freaks out and basically it blows up and I don't know, whatever. But it's a really cool, scary video. And then they try a second time. And this time they try, but they want to create it with memories, and memories that are both stressful and happy, because then the body will be better prepared for being possessed. Soul, an empty vessel that didn't have any memories. And so when Empty Man tried to go in it, it just failed. So James is this new vessel that was created 3 days before the film, or when the film basically starts. Go on, Chrissy.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I was just going to say, the reason that the one in the scary video melted down was because she does explain it to him. She says, we forgot it needed to have an element of fear.
Yeah.
We needed to give it fear. And in a lot of ways, Phil, when you were talking, I just realized that a tulpa in some ways is sort of similar to like a golem.
Yeah.
Good point. Kinda. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. It is religiously, I think it's a little bit different, but.
But it's the Buddhist version.
Yeah. It's an artificial person. And
right. Well, and also, too. When, you know, that equation Eric was talking about, that thought plus concentration plus time equals flesh, that is also, you know, in witchcraft and in magic. I mean, that's, like you just said, Phil, it's kind of like magic, but it sort of is. Because metaphorically, you know, if you want to manifest something, you know, that's what you're doing. You're actively putting your intention into, quote, metaphorical flesh. So, like, if I want to do a spell and say I want to make more money, you know, once I do that spell with intent to attract more money to me, then it becomes this visualization every day of this, like, exactly what they say in the movie, thought and concentration plus time. And you spend your time thinking about it and concentrating on it and bringing it to you and bringing it to you and bringing it to you, and eventually it will come. So I also think it's interesting that in the score, in a couple places in the score, they're playing Requiem. You know, religious, like that very high church, Eric would know, you know, a Requiem, or if it's a style, whatever. Eric's the musician. He would know better than I, but
not anymore. So, it's been a long time.
Yeah, but it's sort of like that idea that this is a religious concept, that it is across all religions, not just, you know, what, you know, Hindu or Buddhist or whatever it is they're creating. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, yeah, we get, I do, yep. Yeah, and I do like, I forget, was it you, Abe, that said it was like a golem?
Yeah, like a blank slate, pretty much.
Yeah. So it is an interesting concept, and they talk about it really early in the film, too, like literally the middle of the film, when our quote-unquote hero goes to the cult, and I forget the name of the cult, the Perfilix Company group or something, I don't know what it was. And what's that?
Pontiff?
Yeah, that Pontiff, right. And Root, the Stephen Root's character, explains it all to us, kind of, sort of. And so if we really paid attention, he was already hinting that James was the Tulpa.
I love that scene because he was so earnest and everything he was saying made so little sense.
And yet it makes complete sense at the end. When
It does. And yeah. I don't know if you noticed this. I wouldn't have had I not been looking at trivia before I went in for my second view. But there's a point where everybody starts to file out of that room where Stephen Root is. And they all walk past a picture on the wall. That is actually a picture of the cabin at the beginning of the movie.
Nice.
Yes, that's, I think I do remember that.
And that's where you come in, Chrissy, with all these pictures are all placed throughout the film. So they're giving us hundreds of hints throughout the film. And yet you don't get it until at the end when it all comes together. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah,
and they still leave a lot of questions unanswered, obviously, as you mentioned, Eric. But all the mystery of what's going on with James is all kind of answered throughout the film with hints, and then finally we figure it out at the end, even if there is a little bit of exposition needed from Amanda. So yeah, it's kind of cool. It's definitely a film worth rewatches, just like you did, Eric.
Mm-hmm. No, I really enjoyed it on rewatch because I didn't have to break my brain as much trying to figure out what was going on because I knew where it was headed already. I could just let it wash over me a little bit more.
Yeah, I enjoyed it the second time better too, because then I could spend my time sort of just looking for little things and looking for interesting stuff rather than trying to figure out what was going on. You know, you can just sort of enjoy the movie for what it is, you know, at the second
one. Indeed. All right. So anything else that anybody wanted to bring up that we didn't discuss? The only thing I really had was to explain what James really was. And I that was my last monologue there. But anything else anybody wanted to bring up?
Well, I did want to mention something here in that supporting, again, one of the themes of reality versus perception, which I think is a big one in this movie. There's a lot of stress on doors in this, but it's more like all the windows and most of the doors in this film they have windows in them, like those 6x9 windows that are broken up into squares. And most of the doors have those windows, like in all the houses, they all have the 6x9s or the ones that are broken up into 9 or 12 smaller panes. And as symbols, this kind of suggests a skewed view, you know? So if you think about it, if you look through a plate glass window, you see what's outside very clearly. But if you look through a segmented one, you're going to get a split, a warped, or a distorted view. And I thought that was just a really nice parallel to kind of say that, okay, James is not really seeing things the way they are. It also kind of ties into the fact that his memories are planted and fake, right? He's made up of pieces. He's made up of different little jigsaw pieces put together. He's not a whole.
He's a metaphysical Mr. Potato Head.
Yes. Pretty much. So I think the windows and the doors, the way those are used in this movie, it also kind of contributes to this. So like I said, you know, there's a lot going on. And if you want to look a little deeper, you can do some Googling, because there are some people out there who have written articles about the philosophical end of this movie, like where the one guy talks about Nietzsche. Somebody out there did write about that. And I know Bear, I think Barrett or somebody we had on the show once was really into that. Maybe it was when we were talking about, Melancholia.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Who joined us for Melancholia?
Dan.
Yes, he was talking a lot about Nietzsche and
yeah, he's heavy in philosophy.
Yeah, so I think there's probably some deep philosophy going on in this movie that I know I'm missing, because that's just not my thing. I mean, I'm interested in it, but I wouldn't be able to tell you, you know, Nietzsche from what's-his-face, you know, and any unless it was spelled out for me.
W-A-T-H-I-S.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And I also like that the title of this film works on two levels. You know, you're talking about the empty man as the being, but you're also talking about the empty man, as in man is a vessel, you know, and James sort of, even though he's created and we don't know that till the end, through most of the film, we believe that he's a real person.
Right.
And he's become empty because he lost his wife and child, because he's no longer a cop.
Well, and so now he's just a real thing, though. Is he not a real person just because he was created? Or is he a real person that was just created?
That's the thing. I think he's a real person that's created, that just has false memories. And when he discovers all that, he's fighting to become real. But he's already doomed even before he can.
Mm-hmm. Because when he finds out all that's fake, he realizes he has nothing. Thus, he is the empty man.
Yeah. So he's. I think he's a real man in the same way that, you know, Dolly the sheep was a real sheep. In other words, they're real, but they just weren't born the normal way.
Gotcha. Okay.
Because if you clone a human,
I was not prepared for the Dolly the sheep comparison.
Well, I was going to say a clone person, but there hasn't been one, unless, you know, the experiments in China that we don't know too much about yet. You got to watch out for the CCP. But But yeah, Dolly seemed like a good analogy because Dolly was a real sheep.
No, that works. I just wasn't ready for it.
Yeah. It's always funny to say Dolly the sheep too. So yeah, so what do you think about that, Chrissy? Since you brought that up, do you think he was a real man, even if he was created out of thin air by some mystical or scientific way?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, and I think that's probably the part that gets into maybe the philosophy that was brought up in this film that I don't quite understand. Like, right. There's a reason that they specifically mentioned Nietzsche. You know what I mean? And I don't know enough about Nietzsche off the top of my head to make that connection, but I suspect there's something having to do with that there. Like, it's the question of existence. You know, are we actually real to begin with? Or, you know, and I know there's philosophers that went into this, but like I said, I have a really awesome friend from college who would be able to explain all this to me in 5 seconds, and I would even be able to rearticulate it. But I'm just not into that. But I'm sure that, you know, there are philosophers and that this movie is addressing some of those. And they're probably being addressed in this film in very subtle ways. So someone who really knows his philosophers, like Dan, Eric, would probably be able to watch this and tell you what kind of comments they're trying to make. Mm-hmm. I just don't know that. I'm not well educated at all in that area.
Nor am I.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. All right. Anything else that anybody had on their list that they wanted to bring up?
I'm good.
I'm all set.
All good. All good.
All right. All right. And Chrissy, I think, was too. So, yeah. All right. Sounds good. All right. Since we did actually talk longer than we originally expected, because there was a couple spots there that we thought were done, but recording about over 2 hours, or just about 2 hours now, so we probably don't have any room for what we've been watching. We can do that next time. But we do have a couple of things. Eric, you actually do another podcast with your buddy Dan.
I do. It's a general interest podcast called the Askancity Podcast. That's spelled Askancity. You can get it wherever you got this one.
And Eric, you, me, and Mike do another podcast where we just had episode six of the podcast just released the other day.
Indeed. It is a podcast where we talk about movies that maybe don't really fit under dark discussions. So we do another show for those that we want to talk about. We kind of rotate and we each choose a movie each time we record. I think the latest one released was Collateral, correct?
Yep, that's right.
Yep. So you can check that out if you want. You can find that with all the other podcasts on darkdiscussions.com.
Yep. And that's the one thing Eric forgot is it's called Cinema a la Carte.
Well, this is Mike's deal. He's not here. Blame him.
That's true.
But but still, you could have asked the mic in your head.
That is true. Excellent. Excellent job. And Barrett, myself and you have been doing a side podcast that is actually 4 years old, but it was on hiatus for a bit. But we've been cranking out a number of episodes recently.
Yes, Halloween Boutique Psychotronic Reviews. We had Pride Month in June, so we did a film a week, lesbian art house films for that. And just this last week, we did a movie with Megan Fox called Till Death. We did a review of that. I'm not sure when that's coming out, but sometime soon.
It came out yesterday.
I missed it. I missed it.
Already had 51 listens. 51 listens already.
Yep. Yeah, that was a fun one to do, too.
Indeed. And then the one prior that was released, episode 26, which was The Summer of Sangale, actress Aiste Dizute. It's very tough to say. She actually commented. She listened to the episode on our website, and she wrote on Twitter. She said, love to have you on to discuss the film. Oh no, that was me replying. let me get back to that again. I have to edit that. Okay, where is it? Here, this might go here. Hello, very interesting discussion. Thank you. Greetings to the creators, and would have been lovely to have joined you. So I threw out an invitation for her if she wanted to come on for like an hour or so to just talk about her career and the film. But that was kind of cool to have her because she was listed as a European up-and-coming star along with Maisie Williams the same year. They were both nominated by that. So that was pretty impressive. All right. So I guess we can give our final thoughts on this movie here, The Empty Man. And once again, Barrett, sorry for not letting you know that Till Death was already released. And we'll start with you, Eric.
I really enjoy this movie. It's a thinker. It makes you think about stuff. I do think it's worth giving more than one watch because there's a lot in here to catch. So if you don't, if it kind of goes over your head the first time, just watch it again. It doesn't mean it's a bad movie. It means there's a lot to unpack. So I would encourage people to be a little patient and give this movie a shot, even though it's not your standard fare. It's unique, and I think it's unique in a good way. And I think it's well made, well acted, well shot. Sound design's amazing. Thumbs up from me.
All right, sounds good. Yeah, for me, it's a really good film. Very, very scary. There's one point in the middle that may cause some issues for some folks. It almost lost me at a point, but then the third act comes back roaring, and this film is absolutely fantastic film. I recommend. Just be warned that it's definitely not a film for everybody because it is, as Eric mentioned, different. But thumbs up for me. Let's go for you, Barrett.
Yeah, I love this film, and after talking about it, I love it even more. I'm definitely going to have to watch it again because I knew as I was watching it, there were lots of things that I wasn't catching, so I definitely want to watch it again. Well worth watching. Two thumbs up. Great movie.
All right, sounds good. And let's go with you, Chrissy.
Yeah, I absolutely loved this film. I highly recommend it, especially if I'm going to, you know, go out on the limb here because I do agree with Barrett. There are some nice airy Astor elements, you know, and if you like things like It Follows, and also if you do like something that, you know, you want to chew on. Like I said, everybody's saying it's definitely a thinking movie. There's a lot in here. And I don't know. I really like this. And I think even if you have to buy it on Amazon, it's well worth your $10. This is definitely a repeat watcher. You're going to get something new out of it every time.
Yeah. This is going to be a film I could rewatch for Halloween for sure. All right. And let's go view Mr. Abe.
I thought this was a solid film. It's really done. I mean, it's a very solid piece. Technically, technically speaking, performance-wise, story is something you probably have to watch more than once just to see things you might have missed, as we discussed. But it's a very good, really good film.
Stop with the bottle! Oh my God, you're freaking me out. Jesus.
But yes, it's definitely a great discussion piece as well. There's a lot, as you heard tonight, we had a lot to talk about. It's a great film overall. I'm very happy we had a chance to look at it. And it's a great, I can't really say anything that hasn't been already said. But it's a film I think you deserve more of a chance than it was given to its poor marketing. So check it out. It's available in a number of places, though you might more likely have to purchase it. If you have any doubts, I hope this review and analysis has encouraged you to maybe consider checking it out.
All right, sounds good. Once again, this is a 2020 film, The Empty Man, part of the purchase of Disney of the 20th Century Fox Library, one of the films that was sitting to be released when they picked it up. It sat on the shelf for a little bit since 2017, released October 2020. And then VOD everywhere in January. The film is getting positive to mixed reviews, if that matters to you, by critics, which is generally a good thing for horror films. though oddly the audience members do not like it, and probably, again, it could be because the wrong people went to see the film. The movie is available anywhere VOD is available. As folks know, everybody here purchased it, but you can also rent it for $3 to $4 less than the purchase price of $9.99, and it can be found again pretty much on any rental or purchase service. It also may have a discount, but I didn't bother checking. That's pretty much all I got. So with all that stated, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right. Thanks for tuning in and listening to talk about The Empty Man. Come back next week. We'll have another topic.